Hey Dave, we're back again a week later to have another kind of quick chat on this corona issue developing around the world.
Yeah, I'm excited. The last one we did was quite a hit. Lots of people were commenting on it a lot, and it seems to make sense given it's a developing situation and we have some opinions. Both you and I are sort of we're sort of unusual in this world of medical science in that we're comfortable putting hypotheses out there that are very testable. That was the same way when we were talking things like cholesterol. Well, this is one of those times where it's important for us, I think, to not only do analysis, but to see how it changes as the stories progress.
Yeah, I think so. And there's a lot of question marks out there, even amongst the so-called experts. I mean, there are proposals recently that the increase in rate of infections is kind of very correlated to the increase in testing. So there is going to be a linkage there. And the death rates are obviously going to be more telling, really, than infection rates. And then there are some countries that are doing quite different things, like Sweden. I've been interested the last few days. Are doing much less a lockdown and much more a kind of social distancing, protect the elderly. And it's going to be really interesting to see how their figures differ from neighboring countries who have done full lockdown for weeks. So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting data, but without making judgments per se, we can just discuss it openly.
Well, yeah, and Sweden was, I believe you brought that up last week, right? That they seem to be doing pretty well in spite of having much more, they're calling it the media laissez-faire approach to this. Although things have developed a lot in the last week, they've received a lot more criticism, particularly from their neighboring Scandinavian countries that are more on lockdown and that they're concerned given the death rates climbed up a lot. I think when we last talked, I just took a peek, and I think it was they had around 50 deaths on the day of, or somewhere around that. And this most recent time I looked at, it was closer to like say 150. So there definitely is this increase in total deaths that we're observing thus far. And the question is this rate going to continue? You're right. I'm curious because not that we would want to do this per se, but in a situation in which there's lots of different countries and we don't yet know the answer, and you could say to one country, hey, on your own, why don't you try this policy and then let us know how it works? It's kind of what's happening with Sweden, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a natural experiment they're doing. And probably, in fairness to the Swedish government and the panel, a lot of criticism coming their way. But at the same time, I don't think they're laissez-faire. I don't think they're like just lax by nature. They actually do believe what they're doing is best. They could be wrong, absolutely. But they do seem to believe in it and they have a logic. The only question is, how wrong are they? And the latest figures, exactly as you say, Dave, I just did them yesterday very quickly. So the death rate per million inhabitants is 23.5, looks like. And for nearby Denmark, which is denser populated, but they've done full lockdown for weeks, their death rate is 21. So it's 23 versus 21, which obviously is no different, especially in this kind of thing. However, the Norway, the death rate is 6.5, which is a lot lower, and Finland is 3.5, which is very much lower. So that's probably where the tension is arising, Norway and Finland compares. Now, I don't know, I've been through a lot of
This is taking total cases, right? Like total cases against recorded fatalities.
Well, this is specifically death because I think the cases is so misleading currently with different testing regimes and everything. I'm kind of taking death rates as being much more up to date and much more indicative of a meaningful impact based on your strategy of isolation or distancing versus total lockdown. You know, it's really the death rate that's going to tell you.
I agree. And I guess the one thing I do want to bring up is that there's kind of two ways in which you can look at case fatality rates, which gets brought up often. One is the total cases against the actual number of deaths. The other is the cases that have reached an endpoint, either recovered or discharged versus those that have died. And there's a little bit of a time difference between each. So total cases, of course, it depresses down the total death, the total numbers of death, because you're going to have more incoming new cases. You're going to get diagnosed as having symptoms likely sooner than you'll die of the disease, right? Particularly of an infection. Conversely,
a couple
though,
of weeks, maybe.
Yeah,
anyway.
Exactly. Conversely, the time it'll take to actually recover from the virus will typically be longer than it would take to die of it. You'll probably die closer to, you know, the worst parts of the time span of the disease. So typically the real mortality rate is probably somewhere in between, in a perfect world where we know every single case that exists. And we're not in that world yet because we don't yet have a good sample size. But that said, I did want to bring that up because it's the one concern I have with looking at death rates while we're in an incline, while there's more and more incoming cases, particularly if you've got a small sample size. It's another issue with these Scandinavian countries that the populations are much smaller. So it's a little bit harder to judge, but that is all the more reason why it is kind of interesting to look at them, at least by comparison to each other.
Exactly. I know all of what you said, absolutely true, and a lot of unknowns. So I was looking even at a simpler metric. It's deaths per million people in the country. So it accounts for population. It's very rough. And of course, there's a lag with the cases. We can also look at the case rates, but it gives a kind of a simple compare as to the effectiveness of the strategy, the ultimate number of deaths. Now, with a death rate of 23 in Sweden versus 21 in Denmark nearby, you know, that's not much different. But then Finland and certainly Norway are lower death rates. Now, the thing I'm interested in currently is the whole tempo or the pattern of progression in countries. So, for instance, if Sweden, and it has been suggested, it's not verified, if Sweden started earlier into this exponential rise, then they would have much higher death rates now, obviously. Only a week or two difference in when they started ramping cases would explain this. So I think we need another couple of weeks, sadly, of looking at the overall death rates and comparing, you know, based on a time scale of whether the first 10 cases or the initial ramp was a week or two earlier in one country versus another. So the jury is out. But I know, as you said, a lot of people are bringing the jury in and saying they're wrong. That may indeed be the case. And another thing is, I have no doubt that Sweden, with the much more lax measures, will indeed have a higher rate of maybe infections and deaths. But as you well know, it's the area under the curve in the next month or two of overall deaths averaged up in aggregate, and whether or not the hospital system actually got overwhelmed, which would lead to more deaths than might otherwise have occurred. So there's a lot of moving parts here. So I think the jury's out in Sweden just as of today, April the 1st, 2nd. But in a week or two, I think a picture will emerge, and we'll see how wrong or right they were.
Well, and we need larger numbers. I mean, the one thing that I keep getting interesting information on, because we had talked briefly about Germany from last week, and I kind of followed up and managed to connect with a couple German medical professionals and just kind of asked them on the fly. I was sort of like, you know, why is it that you guys have, you know, a less concerning death rate? And it was brought up that indeed there's, I will tell you, Ivor, one thing that's sort of fascinating that does kind of bother the engineer in me is that there really is a lack of uniformity in how deaths from coronavirus are counted, right? So let me give you an example. And this isn't just a per country thing. This is a per hospital thing in many respects. Is somebody comes in, they've got a raging fever, but they're also enduring a myocardial infarction at that moment in time, right? Like that's what brought them into the hospital. They may have even had a fever for, say, 3 days, but they chose not to come until they were experiencing chest pains. Unfortunately, this in this hypothetical, that patient dies, right? Now, does that patient get tested? Do we confirm that there was coronavirus? If we do confirm that there was coronavirus, is that considered a contributing factor? If so, does it get recorded as related to the death in the larger aggregate of the numbers? Or is it, the heart attack that's considered the reason? And all of this leaves open some very interesting questions. And that got brought up by particularly one of the German medical professionals who was saying that her concern was that perhaps they're not getting counted quite the same way as that they would be in other countries. But another thing that I didn't actually realize that has been brought up, not just by her, but also from medical professionals in other countries, is that there's enormous pressure to bear right now from not just the hospital system in particular, but the hospital that they're working at. There's concerns about things like liability and class action lawsuits and so forth that have to do with the potential of how the hospital's appearance looks. And this is kind of relevant to a thread that I was just linked to just today on how there's a group that's trying to donate masks and the bureaucratic challenges they're running into have a lot less to do with whether or not the medical professionals on the other end need the masks and have more to do with, for example, how much it's perceived that the existing hospital that they're trying to donate it to, from their perspective, admits to having a lack of the available equipment. Now that seems like something we shouldn't have to deal with right now. If there's the need for the help, we should be able to identify the need and meet that need. But these are the kinds of things that are going to impact the data that we're seeing at the end of the day as to not just the need for these medical professionals, but for that matter, the outcomes of the virus itself.
Yeah, I'd agree. And just parsing it out there, there's the death calls and how that's recorded, and then there's things like this whole mask allocation. But the death calls, I've seen quite stunning things as in official guidance for hospitals. So I believe in general, if someone was late stage cancer or had some other severe problem, hospitalized in the past, if they had, say, an influenza and a bit of a fever, that didn't really figure. But I believe official documents are now advising that if someone has corona, that gets logged. In other words, in the UK, it's now become a disease you must log in with the death form. Whereas before, influenzas and other fevers were not actually notifiable. So that's obviously going to skew the data all over the place. Also, Italy, I think, largely acknowledged that they were putting down corona when it was suspected or actual on pretty much all the deaths that were associated with corona. And it's possible Germany are not quite doing that. They may be doing something a little more like traditional orthodox medical categorization. Though I did mention last week that there is a case, a German professor noted, of a stage four serious cancer in their last weeks. And they did get attributed to corona because they passed a corona test a couple of days before. But long story short, I've seen other guidance. I'm not sure is it UK or America, but official guidance, which says if it is actual test positive or suspected to record corona. Now that or suspected is obviously a pretty big question by anyone's standards. Yeah, and the masks. I released a video yesterday from a Japanese documentary, March 21st, I think, and a really stunning sequence of experiments carried out in Japan by a university department. And they show someone coughing, sneezing, and even just talking and laughing. And they have multiple laser interferometry to see all the particles, even down to a micron. And it's quite stunning how virus-carrying particles, that there are so many of them up to a meter or more away, and in an enclosed space, they will stay there for 10 to 15 minutes or more, right? The heavy ones will drop. But when you see the visualization, it's just stunning. And it just kind of says that masks are a no-brainer, even if they don't fit perfectly. It just seems like such a no-brainer that, and even I would suggest that even the bandanas or anything that catches tiny droplets, rather than letting them go out into the atmosphere. And in these experiments, they had people stationary. But if you imagine people moving, then the meter or 1.5 meter cloud, you know, people will move through it. And there's no question but they will pick up these droplets. So it was an amazing experiment to visualize.
Yeah, I'm extremely, particularly in the last, I want to say, week since we've talked, I've done a lot more investigating. There's a viral video under the hashtag Masks for All, which is looking into, I'm forgetting the country, but there's a country that has an extraordinarily low number, and it's a South American country. For some reason, I'm not placing it right now, but they have basically just taken on everybody wear masks. If you're leaving your home, wear a mask. It doesn't even matter if it's a perfectly well form fitted mask. Basically, at the end of the day, we're trying to prevent the respiring of these large droplets, especially because it's not just that they're going out into the air, but they're resting and becoming the fomites everywhere on these surfaces. But on top of that, yes, even the small mist that you're talking about can remain in the air for a period of time. If you're going to, a grocery store or a gas station or something where it's not open air, it's all that much more likely that it can remain. You can walk right into the mist cloud, not even realize that somebody was there just, 10 minutes earlier. That's absolutely a factor that we should be thinking about moving forward. And it's so cheap. Masks, I mean, yes, talk about a bandana. Sure. Whatever can help to further prevent the spread is something that needs to be considered, but this is something that doesn't, it's not as expensive as a ventilator. We can all start to use them fairly soon. So I myself, I've been starting to take steps. I have my wife got me for our traveling a Buff. Again, not as good as an N95 by any means, but if it's something that I can travel with and I can just treat it as though I'm already infected, I think that's generally good practice for everybody. And it's something that I'm going to be using when I'm going to the grocery store, is if I've got to make the trip, I don't care how I look, I'm gonna do that prevention. That's gonna be something important for me.
And yeah, if people only visualized, it may not be that easy, but the video, we might put a link actually as we share this video to that Japanese documentary. But the professor in that was saying, yes, well, these 5 micron micro droplets you see in our experiments, they will carry many viruses. And if people just visualized a multiple layer of cloth and just in your mind be a microscope and zoom in and take 5, 10 micron particles. And see, will they pass all the way through the tortuous layers of cloth and fibers, remaining as a droplet and getting out the far side? And the answer is, of course not. A massive amount of them will simply adhere to the fibers. And the other thing is viral load. So it is suggested, it makes sense, not proven, but if you take in a viral load of, say, I don't know, 100 viruses versus 1,000 or 10,000, it could very much greatly affect the outcome and the severity. So obviously, yet again, the mask in a given exposure environment is going to greatly reduce the viral load, which in itself is a huge.
That's actually something I'd been investigating early on. In fact, I had talked with Jake Kushner about it, let's say like 3 weeks ago. And I was very interested in how much the inoculum, the dosage that you get, really does matter towards the end level of severity for the disease you have. And it's really, I mean, when you think about it's really basic math, right? You have a certain amount that's in your bloodstream. As per the nature of viruses, they're hacking your cells, they're making use of the ribosomes to multiply. And when and by how much your immune response can be mounted is extremely relevant to the success in their fight against this virus, right? So the more that you have in your system before that detection can take place, before, because a lot of what I think people don't realize is your immune response isn't spring-loaded to its 100%. You actually have to do things like transcribe proteins and get the actual immune cells into the field, as it were. If you need to build a fever, and I mean, the more immune cells you have in play at the point that that fever is starting is, of course, mathematically going to be relevant in the cascade of fighting the disease. So, yes. If I'm going to get infected, by golly, I want it to be the smallest amount possible that I can have within my body at the point that my immune system is activated to then go fight it. I mean, just for the same reason that if I were on a battlefield, I'd want the enemy and their troops to be smaller in number before we get a chance to take them on. So yes, that's pretty relevant.
And the analogy extends the battlefield one, now that I think of it, because you want to be exposed to the foreign troops and invaders and learn their methods and better consider your strategy on dealing with them. And that's what your immune system's going to have to do. So an early introduction to a small number is beneficial, you would say, in so many vectors. And you know what? More virus, as you say, it's mats in a way, and it is, as you describe. But I can think of another thing where more is obviously much worse. I'll see, can you think of it? And the answer is native LDL particles. Clearly, if we have a nominal amount, that's fine. And if we have around 30 or 40% more, they destroy our arteries, right?
Sure. I thought April 1st was yesterday, though. We're recording this on April 2nd. So, you know what, though? I had some good news that I wanted to be sure that I shared. In fact, I just did a tweet thread earlier today, just before we recorded this. And I've been keeping an eye on the 50,000 foot view, as we would say here in the States, which is another way of just saying the big macro level of the data. There's problems with looking at big data, but there's also a lot to be said for looking at larger trends. And I've been in particular interested not just in the cases as they go day by day, because no question since we last talked, unfortunately, today, I'm pretty sure we're going to cross 1 million cases worldwide, like just today. So those cases are increasing exponentially, no question. The bigger question to me is that rate of change, the exponential rate of change, is that changing? And I'm happy to say, and I just released this, it's very preliminary and it's really just only current as of today, but I kept looking back to the last 28 days, so about a month, and the rate of change then was 1.156, which, by the way, is much better than what it was when I started this research, which was closer to 1.19. And for people who don't know what a rate of change is, this is a bit of a simplifying of it, but think of whatever number it is that you're looking at. And let's say it is 1.19, that's close to 20%. That means whatever number you're looking at today, if the rate of change, if the interval is per day, then that means tomorrow there'll be 20% more of that number. And then tomorrow you'll again apply 20% more, and so on. And so what you end up doing is looking at, okay, how often at this rate of change will the total number double? That's usually the best way people can comprehend it. And what I'm excited to say is that the rate of change at 28 days was 1.156. The last 14 days is 1.139, which is a drop. And for the last 7 days, it's 1.19, which is basically almost half of the 1.19 that it was at the beginning. But then the last 3 days, and granted that's a small sample size, less confidence, but the last 3 days it's been 1.1. So 10% day over day is, I think, very exciting. I hope that that trend holds and that we continue going down. Well, at a 1.1, rather than doubling every 3 days like we were at the 1.19, we'd be doubling every 7 days. Now, I realize to people that may still sound like it's not that big of a difference, but it's a massive difference. It's really huge because, again, we're talking it doubles and then it doubles again and so forth. Well, what we're trying to get down to is a rate of change of 1.0, because then it's not changing at all. And then once we can start getting below that, it starts dropping off. And now we can start talking about things like how quickly the cases half. So, for example, at 1.19, they half every, I believe it is, 6.5 days. We want to get to the other side of that because, again, the virus itself plays itself, it's the sickness, coronavirus plays itself out over, say, 2 weeks. And the more that we can stretch the total time for the incoming cases to bring down, the more that we can help the medical professionals, or for that matter, the leaders and the manufacturers, to be able to catch up and work with this disease as it stands. So that rate of change dropping, I think, has just been fantastic. Now, the obvious caveat, there are, of course, other factors beyond the ones that we're discussing here today. It may not just be social distancing. It may not just be quarantine. It may not just be travel restrictions. But I absolutely speculate that all of those have played a big part in this drop in the rate of change.
Yeah, so no doubt they'll play a part for sure. I mean, that's kind of as common sense as the masks are. True. The testing, I don't have clear line of sight to very accurate data on the testing rates and the testing methodologies. So early on in an epidemic, you may see massive doubling rates because you've basically made a surge in your testing. So you're going to generate an enormous growth. And then I noticed Denmark on March the 12th changed their strategy on testing completely. And they reduced the testing right down to key cases from the broader testing. So that's going to change things the other way. So we don't know for sure. And
Do you know why they did that? Is it just a lack of available tests?
I think it was a test capacity. I just made sure when I saw it noted in the Worldometer, I made sure I included that in the graph too, because as you know, anything that changes in testing rate or strategy is going to utterly undermine the data. So I just noted it, but I'm not sure.
And that's also why I like the bigger data, is while I'm very much aware that a lot of these countries are changing some idiosyncratic things, I'm counting on some level at the aggregate level that we're, you know, at least in the big data, we're able to parse out some of these trends, fully acknowledging how rough it is.
It is rough. And if the big data includes everything that physically happened and changes in strategy, then it's fantastic. You can retrospectively go back in and decode, if you will, this exactly as we're talking about. However, if things change and they're not noted in the big data can't really tell you so well. So it is a tricky one, that practices change. And the death one is another good example of this. Italy acknowledged that only 12%, I think, of the deaths did not have another cause. You know, countries may be different on this in how they attribute deaths. And if you start changing your policy from kind of taking pneumonia and not having it as a cause of death, really, it's just an associated thing that maybe speeded the death. But if you change to telling everyone to record COVID as the cause of death, even if it's suspected, then the big data is going to reflect that decision.
Of course. I think it should go without saying that going off suspicion alone is not good at all. Like I want verification, even if there's a lack of tests. And for that matter, I'm sure you agree with me, we would prefer that countries be as consistent as possible, even if it's within their own policy, and even if there's lots to disagree with in their own policy. It really sucks to not have continuity of the data.
Yeah. And to that point, even if they gave both, I mean, it wouldn't be that hard that they gave the kind of traditional cause of death as it would have been with a pneumonia, whatever that be, cancer or heart disease, and also showed, though, the deaths that had the COVID verified fully beside it. And then you could look and you could say, all right, okay, there's the true picture because we can see both. But if you're only giving the latter, well, then you have the problem we're talking about, but we'll see.
I actually, for what it's worth, I also have a poll that I ran last night, which really showed some very surprising results. And unfortunately, Twitter's taking its time trying to get to it. But here we go. So, and I think to make this a little more interesting, we should actually answer these questions ourselves. I don't know if you've answered this yet. But generally speaking, do you feel your government, as in either your government, is underreacting, overreacting, or acting appropriately in response to this pandemic? How would you answer that?
Okay, well, as per last week, I can answer that positively, which I'm delighted to do on behalf of my countrymen and women. Basically, yeah, Ireland has done pretty well, I would say, overall. And from a couple of weeks ago, social distancing, gaps in stores, controls at store doors where they let five or six in, five or six out to keep sparsely populated, marking the ground for distancing measures, hand cleaning. And for the last couple of weeks, they've done what I think was an appropriate social distancing without lockdown. Now, a few days ago, they've done more like a knockdown, and they're saying, look, unless you're in a really important job or just for trips you need to make, kind of stay within a 2 kilometer radius. And, you know, they were checking on that, verifying people who were driving around that they were doing something valid. So, more of a lockdown, if you will. And that was just, again, to protect the hospital capacity, because it's probably very important for people to realize, in some sense, and I don't mean to appear callous, in my world of crisis management from the last 20 years, this would be identified very quickly to be a hospital capacity issue primarily. In other words, if the hospital capacity can handle this sudden spike with this new kind of disease and they could handle it, no extra people would die. But if the hospitals get swamped and you're turning away people, then more people will die than they would have otherwise. So it's very much all around maintaining adequate hospital capacity while we go through this. So Ireland, I think, made the right calls when they were worried about capacity being exceeded potentially. They tightened down more. They may only do that for a week or two and then back off, all depending on hospital capacity. I think they did very well. And I think that other countries may have gone overboard. And I think other countries like Sweden, if they all had masks, and if they were tougher on the stance they took, I think it would have been okay. But I think it's maybe a little too lax, and that might be where they suffer.
I think that I would have answered underreacting on mine, which again is hard for me to even say, given I'm very pro-freedom in general. But part of my issue is that I feel like in us allowing in the US for states to have very inconsistent policies between each other seems kind of silly. Like if we're going to do a lockdown, then we should do a lockdown, particularly that 2 week block of time if that's what we're going for. But that said, you know, that's where we went. Now there's, I want to say like another 12 questions. We probably can't get through them all, but I'm going to say what the big highlights are. To my surprise, there really were quite a lot. There's 40% that were saying that their government was underreacting. And the generally speaking, do you think the media is underreacting? Actually, most people, about 57.5%, said overreacting as far as the media goes. As far as private citizens, 52.5% felt that they were underreacting to this pandemic. But one of the more fascinating things that I think I saw was what everyone's prediction of the true fatality rate is. So I had four answers: below 0.5%, 0.5 to 1%, 1% to 2%, and above 2%. What would you have answered on that one?
So, at the end of the day, after this passes, and we look back at the true infections versus the true mortality, is presuming. I think it's going to be pretty. Yeah, I think it's going to be on the lower side, down at the 0.5 or below, unless the hospitals are overrun and large numbers are turned away. I think we also got to keep in mind the discussion we had 10 or 15 minutes ago about the cause of death. I mean, if you took the true mortality rate and you remove from it people who are imminently, sadly, you know, on their way to mortality, then it's going to be really, really low, as you can imagine. In Ireland, the figures are that I have mean or median age of infection is 46. And the median age of death is 80 or above at last count. And we've had a series of clusters in nursing homes, you know, for the elderly who have multiple conditions.
You know, this brings up an important point too. First, let me give my answer. Because I definitely am very different than yours. Right now, I want to believe it's going to be 0.5 to 1%. Right now, the data keeps pulling me over to 1% to 2%. And I should emphasize something. I do think that we can't quite get away from, yes, how much there will be death associated to a lack of hospital capacity. There will be some amount of death, so that it's kind of hard to disentangle that. It, you know, once this is all over and we're looking back, it's not easy to say, oh, well, there would have been less deaths, you know, except for when we can look at those hospitals that had seemingly more capacity. Because even those that would have had more capacity would probably have, say, for example, less supplies and staffing due to what's going on in other places that were past capacity. So it's hard to disentangle those two. But let me actually throw out one other skeptic case I heard presented to me that I think is worth mentioning, you know, aside from my agreement or disagreement with it, which is, okay, what if in fact the true fatality rate of COVID-19 is actually close to that of the flu, but it has a greater level of infectiousness to such a degree that inevitably it was going to have this clustering of overwhelmingness, right? So let's say it's you know, the flu is typically 0.1, but we're armed and ready for it. We're already used to the flu season. We're already used to the patterns. It's actually surprisingly predictable as, you know, viral intake goes and how it is that we would prepare our hospital system. But let's say all of a sudden you had 5 new strains of the flu, and they were really the same one, but they kind of came in all at the same time and then created these clustering problems throughout because they had a greater level of infectiousness. I think that that's an interesting case to consider. I don't think it's that. I do think that COVID-19 is going to prove to be substantially deadlier than the flu. But it is an interesting thought experiment to consider how much of its deadliness has to do with how much it's surprised our existing healthcare infrastructure, and particularly in how it's gotten a foothold early on the spread.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've kind of heard that one. But my reading on it is I'm happy enough that it's a bad, very bad flu. And let's say it's 5 times worse for a given person to get it than the more common flu. And that's a lot. So that's what I'm kind of currently assuming. You know, there is a spike now, but even if you look at the countries that have not exceeded their capacity and therefore they can take care of people, they've still got a big spike right now in deaths. Now, they may be heavily biased towards the older and people with illnesses, just like the flu is, but there's a very big spike. I don't think it's just because it's hit really fast and infected a lot of people. I think it's a very severe flu. I know I'm not saying it's a flu, but it's much more severe. That doesn't mean it's a catastrophe. If you have the capacity to treat everyone appropriately, then it's not catastrophic. Maybe 5 times worse than the flu. It'll be interesting to see the normal seasonal deaths pertaining to flus and things against this spike that we're seeing now with COVID. I mean, I haven't really seen that data yet, but we'll have to look back and look at that to try and get the answer. What do you think?
To give skeptics their due in this, there certainly will be a number of cases that, a number of fatalities especially, that are going to come back to the lack of capacity given the per patient intake. So certainly some people are, you know, need to go on a ventilator that would have been available if it were just what the anticipated rate was. So to that extent, I mean, I think it is worth keeping track of that. It is worth keeping in mind, hey, wait a sec, let's say that the next pandemic isn't as bad as COVID-19, but even so, how many people will we lose to just not being prepared at all for another pandemic? I'd like to think that that's definitely changing. I'd like to think that there's going to be greater capability to both detect and then respond to another potential emerging pandemic. But all that said, it is kind of surprising when you really look back at just what we've had, in this century. We've already had a few different pandemics worthy of our attention to give us some warning that this was coming. And we could look back at the Spanish flu from last century. That was truly catastrophic, truly, to the extent that you can be sure that many people who were in the middle of it said, boy, every single country is absolutely never going to let something like this happen again. There's no way that we'd be caught flat-footed. And really, a century ago is a short span of time in human history, right?
But again, 1918, I watched a documentary on it, and it would wipe the floor with corona. I mean, there's no comparison. It was vastly worse in its impact. I mean, it was hitting huge amounts of young people and 20 to 40-year-old, apparently healthy. They may have had nutrient deficiencies, but it was a ravager. A 1957 flu. There was a huge tail of death for people below 15 years of age, as well as the normal older and sicker. So yeah, it's a comparison, but I just think they appear to me to be vastly worse. What would be interesting, now this is controversial, and I'm only stating it because it's out there, it's reported on, and it's discussed. So apparently, if you're put on a ventilator and you reach the threshold, rough and tough, 25% of people emerge from that stage of this disease, especially with comorbidity. And I'm not sure, I was interested, what percentage would emerge if they did not have access, but they had all the other care, but didn't have the ventilator? And I'm not sure how different the outcome would be. Would 15% emerge, or 20, or zero? And some indications are.
I generally get the impression that once a doctor determines you need to be on a ventilator, that that's what it's going to take, that you're almost certainly going to die if you don't have it. Like, it's not, I think even 15% is probably optimistic. Like, I think it's probably a lot less than that.
The problem is we are speaking with a complete absence of data. And then the real this discussion is complete absence. So if we know it's 20, because people who are very severe, it's a high threshold for a ventilator, I think say 25% actually pull through, because it's such a late stage. When you're at that stage, that's fine. We don't actually have any data on the other question. I've seen some from Zoe Harcombe, but we don't really have that data. But it would be a very obviously, a very important piece of data to know the efficacy of that. But I guess we may never know. There will be no placebo.
Well, I think we're coming up on, we kind of wanted to try to keep this to about an hour so that we could kind of do this a little more often. I do sort of like these updates. What do you think, if you were to predict maybe coming up in the coming week, that might be a change from what we're getting used to seeing?
Oh, any kind of change in the perception of this issue, or the actions taken?
Material change. Do you think that there'll be some changes in policy? Do you think that will, for that matter, let's start with Sweden. Do you think Sweden will change its policies, or do you think it'll stick with where it's at, regardless of where the data is taking it?
Yeah, I don't think they'll stick regardless. If there is enormous political pressure on them, and there is enormous media pressure on them, on top of the pressure of fear, which is beyond enormous, obviously. And they are politicians at the end of the day. So I think if their data begins to look in any way bad in death rate relatively to Denmark, because we might put aside Finland and Norway just for the moment, because other things may explain that, they're going to roll pretty quick when they start to look worse, or when their capacity in the hospitals is reached and the pressure really comes on. And then they will switch, I'm guessing. But then it's a bit late. So then you can question the wisdom of their whole process all along. But, you know, it's a bit late when you're already reaching capacity, because the couple of weeks lag time from infection through to the death peak, you know, you're going to have to face into that over the next couple of weeks, even after you've locked down. It's very tricky, Dave. It's a tricky question. It'll depend on the data, but I think if things level off and the doubling rates and the deaths reach a kind of peak, then country by country, they'll begin to back off. But I still think the biggest question of all is around the preparatory nature for this. But I'll have to go back to your flu question. So Taiwan have got 30 million people. They're right near the epicenter of this beside China. They have half the population of Italy, but they have like 6-7 deaths, and they started earlier. They obviously started very early, and they only have 400 cases. So I think what will come out of this more than anything else on the preparatory point will be masks, no brainer, forehead temperature measurements widely spaced around all your businesses and schools that you want to keep running, your economy, so people are identified with a fever immediately. And then tracking and social support for the government from the people, that everyone will get with the program, share when they think they have an infection, self-isolate, protect the elderly and at risk, and support them. You know, all of these measures, I think, in the future will become much more the default, I hope, because that's what will change the game more than lockdown. I mean, way more than lockdown, I think, is all of those good.
I agree with everything you said just now. Like, I agree with Sweden's possible effect and the likely response. Certainly, the pressure will really mount if their cases and their death rates are climbing substantially. I likewise agree that, look, let's call it what it is. There needs to be a greater proactive participation on the part of us as citizens to limit this spread. We can't. No amount of borrowing and spending and, you know, movement on the part of leaders is going to protect us from this this issue that we need to all kind of take ownership of. You know, something that's been very weird for me, Ivor, is I, especially with my Twitter presence lately, I've been putting more efforts towards trying to raise awareness. And I don't consider myself the rah-rah activist by any means. For things like this, but I do feel I couldn't sleep at night if I didn't take more measures to try to get the word out myself. And again, not typical for me on the engineering side, and I kind of don't like taking positions per se, but some things like just advocating for wearing a mask outside your home is such a no-brainer that we should do what we can to get it across. And look, a lot of these things, such as the severity of this pandemic, such as the degree of relevance for things like masks, I had a different opinion on. I saw the data. The data changed my mind. Now it's not just a matter of acknowledging what is really working versus what isn't, seeing it on a spreadsheet, making a graph, and being satisfied with that for myself and then presenting it, but also saying, guys, you know, family, friends, let's do this. Let's get involved to try to limit this as much as we can, because frankly, there's only so much governments can do. There's only so much medical professionals can do. They're already taxed out. We need to be able to see what we can do ourselves and, you know, help get the word out, like what we're kind of doing right now.
Yeah, agreed totally, Dave. And that's a great way to wrap it up. And absolutely, I think we've seen the democratization of science, of medicine, the past 10 years with cholesterol and fat and overturning a lot of myths. And now I think there should be democratization of response to these kinds of things. We don't leave it to our elders and betters in government and politicians who just don't have expertise anyway. The people need to take the preventative measures and embrace them rapidly when there's an emerging issue like this. And then the people will own protecting themselves as a people. I mean, you can't get better than that. And the last thing I might say is, because we talked about masks a lot and about the best simple measures, I could tag on at the end of this video, because we're both going to share this video, I could tag on just a couple of minutes around those measures, just as an outro, maybe.
Yeah, for sure. Let's do it.
Okay, so anyone watching this, hold on, hang on when we finish, and you'll get to see some very interesting stuff.
I'll see you next week, Ivor.
Good man, Dave. See you next week. Bye now.
Hey, these are the same.
The team will track particles in the air using laser beams and a high-sensitivity camera. This technology allows us to detect droplets as small as 0.1 micrometers wide. The experiment starts. First, sneezing. We can see a large droplet, about 1 millimeter in diameter. It quickly falls. But let's look through the high sensitivity camera. We can see small particles that seem to glitter floating through the air. These particles are all smaller than 10 micrometers, or 1/100th of a millimeter in diameter. Let's take a look from a different angle. They're small and light. You can see them drifting through the air. These are micro droplets. We're learning that sneezing isn't the only source of these droplets. We ran the same experiment on a close-range conversation. People generate a lot of micro droplets when they talk loudly. The droplets between these two stay where they are. They don't drift away.
そのマイクロ飛沫、小さな粒子の中にもたくさんのですね、生きたウイルスがいて、大きな声での会話、あるいは激しい息遣い、そういった中でですね、このマイクロ飛沫ができて、それが近くの人、その人が吸い込むことによって感染が広がる、そういったリスクが見えてきたものと思います。
This simulation uses only micro droplets. 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, twenty minutes later, the micro droplets are still floating in place.
So how should we deal with it as a society and prevent the spread of anxiety? Taiwan has drawn plaudits for its response. It has managed to limit the number of cases to 169 and the number of deaths to just two.
Children arrive at school. Life continues as normal in Taiwan, where authorities have successfully implemented strict preventive measures. Thermographic cameras are set up at school gates. If a child shows a temperature higher than 37.5 degrees Celsius, they are sent home. They're checked again before class starts. The school contacts parents of children with high fevers. They have to report their recent movements to the authorities. How was Taiwan able to implement such measures so quickly? The government delayed the start of the semester by 2 weeks in February to head off mass infection. This allowed schools to put in place preventive measures for when they reopened. These included clear standards to guide closures. If one student or teacher was infected, the individual class was shut down. Two infections, and it was the entire school. An online learning system was also put in place.
欢迎收看台北市国小国语线上教学影片。
The government ordered the development of a virtual classroom. It's now ready for immediate use. Chen Shih-chung is in charge of all coronavirus measures in Taiwan. He has the same authority as a prime minister. He granted NHK his first exclusive interview since the start of the outbreak. He holds a press conference every day to give updates on the virus. He covers a wide range of topics, from new infections to warnings to citizens.
抢抢抢，卫生纸、尿布，想买没得买。连锁大卖场同样涌入人潮，卫生纸每。
In response to panic buying, 整个购物车还有民众
买了五六包白米。其实台湾的那种相对的民生物资哈是绝对不会缺的。好，那大家想想看，我们的日子都在过，这物资本来就在。哦，所以过度的哈来这样的存这样的物资或过度的抢购是没有必要的。
He spends nearly 2 hours answering every question in order to put citizens at ease. 在我们的居家检疫这条线就能够防。Taiwan is also taking measures to fight against the shortage of everyday goods.The government manages all face mask stocks and sells them at pharmacies and convenience stores. Adults are allowed to buy up to 3 a week for themselves and 5 for children. You have to present your health insurance card to buy any, and the system records purchase history to prevent hoarding.
他卡就知道说他还没有满七天，还没有满七天就不能领。
The government also developed an app to help people who are too busy to go to the pharmacy themselves. You can use it to make a reservation and pick up your order whenever you want at a 24-hour convenience store.
好，你要找一个简单的事情，做出一个有效率的决策，让大家看到你这个效率的结果。那经由小的政策来建立人民对你的信心，那接下来你的大的政策，大家才有办法跟你配合。在对抗病毒的时候，其实病毒来袭哈，一个是来侵犯我们的心理了，一个是侵犯我们的生理。说我们每一天好定时的跟国人报告全部的情况，让整个疫情透明化，让民众跟政府能够站在一起，那我们共同防疫才会成功。
Professor Kaku, what can we learn from Taiwan?
It's a great model. It is a very detailed response. They made thorough preparations and were one or two steps ahead of the outbreak, putting their measures into practice.